And welcome to Thrift Shop Biography. This is the one about Bob Dylan. Thank you for listening.
Hello.
Hello.
Well, this week I found in the thrift shop Bob Dylan's autobiography. What's it called?
Chronicles Part 1.
Yeah, Part 1. So it's almost like Volume 1 of a series of records, but he never wrote anymore.
No, I think that's a bit of a jokey title, isn't it? Part 1, knowing there's not going to be a Part 2.
I reckon he's a hilarious japes man, isn't
he? Did you find this to be a funny book?
No.
No. I think there were elements of humour in there.
They are very, very dry. But actually, he probably is a very dry humorist.
Do you think he was sat there writing it, laughing his head off? Okay, before we get into this, completely describe this book in one word.
Folk. Or I'd say poetry. What would you say?
Confusing.
Oh, okay. Now I'm going to ask you what you thought of Bob Dylan before you read this.
Always loved Bob. He's just been part of my musical history as much as like the Beatles and Elvis, really. He's just one of those musical icons. Many famous tunes that we all know and love. Always really liked him, actually. But more recently, I've liked him as an artist, as in a visual artist, a painter. And I've been to a couple of exhibitions of his work. And it just knocked me out that he's that good at something else, you know. I think he's a true artist. I think he's brilliant at music and lyrics, and now it turns out painting as well. In terms of writing a book, I just wish the book was a bit more accessible. I found it confusing, but anyway, we'll get on to that. How do you feel about Bob Dylan?
It's not my music. I mean, I'm a bit more disco, but it's like you say, it's in the airwaves. It's just in the airwaves. If a Bob Dylan song came on, I sing along to it. Then I wouldn't necessarily put it on, saying that I do have an album. Funny that I sort of thought of him as from the 60s. So through this book, I've learned that he's never stopped. I said, no, he's knocking out albums pretty much one or two a year till this year. I think one came out last month. I didn't know that he was going this whole time. Yeah. To me, he kind of stopped. Because he stopped having hits.
I think that's the thing. If there's an artist you kind of like, but not enough to buy their music, you only really know about them as long as they're in the hit parade.
That's right.
And once the popularity of the singles falls off and they become an albums artist, they don't necessarily know too much about them.
Exactly. Only the fans know. He keeps talking about how, because he's a legend, you only go and see a legend once, then you're not really bothered after that. And that, which is why he keeps trying to reinvent himself. Mm-hmm. I guess people still go and see him. He's toured forever, hasn't he? He still tours.
Well, he did the never-ending tour, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
He's just a working musician, isn't he?
Yes.
So he's going to keep on keeping on.
I saw him once, you know.
I saw him once.
What?
You've just reminded me. You've just reminded me. I was walking through, like, on brand at Greenwich Village.
What?
And this guy is walking the other way. And I thought, God, he looks like Bob Dylan. And then he got right up next to me and I thought, fucking hell, it's actually Bob Dylan.
In Greenwich Village?
Yeah. And then he was gone.
Wow. He still wanders about. That's great that he can do that. Because obviously this book tells us about times when he really couldn't do that anymore.
When did you see him?
Well, I actually saw him in a festival.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't as amazing and like hallucinatory as that.
I would rather have seen him play a set than just walk past him on the street. Oh, was he crap?
That's magical. That's amazing. Yeah, a legend doesn't wander past you in the street.
So, like, the basic facts we usually start this podcast with are just not in this book, right? Well, they kind of are, but they're not told in a chronological order.
No.
But I can say with much confidence
yes.
that Robert Zimmerman was born in 1941 in the town of Duluth in Minnesota, which is just a small, unremarkable
town. Steel industry.
It has a shipyard there, even though it's the town that's furthest away from the ocean in America.
Yeah.
But the ships still come through it.
I also wondered that. Is there a massive wide river that goes, is it the ships go through his landlocked land anyway?
Anyway, it's a very unremarkable small town. And he has quite an unremarkable life. He doesn't tell us what his mum and dad do, does he?
Yes, he does. This is how confusing this book is, because it literally dips in and out. But his dad grew up in that town and he was one of five, and he ended up doing night classes to become an accountant and was working in the oil company when he met
Betty,
mum. And she'd grown up in the town just across the tracks, which just had a gas station, a general store, horse stables, and a school. That was it. So they really are from old rural America, yeah. Back and beyond sort of thing. Very ordinary people. It seems like the mindset is you get a job, you work, and that's what you do. They weren't unpleasant or strict or anything. No, yeah. They were just really normal. And his brain was just creative and they didn't really understand each other.
He said his dad wanted Bob to do mechanical engineering.
Yeah, yeah.
But Bob wasn't good at school.
No.
He didn't get any decent grades at all.
No.
In fact, he says that mostly what I did growing up was bide my time.
He's preformed. He's born Bob Dylan, isn't he?
Yeah.
Very intelligent and thoughtful person.
I think he knew from a young age that he was going to get out of that little town at some point. Yes. But like you say, he didn't have a miserable existence. A lot of these books we read, people have a horrible time as a child. But he just had an average childhood having fun in his small town with his mates.
Ice skating, right. If you think of his upbringing, if you think of Snoopy, you know how it's often snowing and they're ice skating a lot? That's Minnesota. And it's like minus 10 in the winter, he said, sometimes with a minus 20 chill factor. You know, you're used to cold and you have to get a bit into your head. Prince is also from there. And he says, basically, it drives you indoors to become creative and do other things.
Yeah.
He's having a really ordinary childhood, which is why he doesn't bother talking about it much. But he does say that a teacher said to his dad that Robert or Bobby, she said he's an artist. He said, oh, what do you mean he paints? An artist to me is just someone who paints. It's just the broader, he's an artist's mind. He's got an artist's mind.
Yeah. I like his dad's advice to him. He says, remember, Robert, in life anything can happen. Even if you don't have all the things you want, be grateful that you don't have the things that you don't want. And that's just a good way of looking at stuff. It's like you can be grateful for stuff that you don't have.
Like a broken leg.
Yeah. If you don't have one.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, it's quite an uneventful childhood.
Yeah.
And then when he's old enough, he gets out of the little town and he goes to Minneapolis.
Yes.
So he goes to Minneapolis. His cousin is at university there, and he pretty much runs one of the fraternity houses. He's a proper jock.
Yeah. Is that what we call halls of residence?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's the summer holidays, so he says to little Robert, oh, yeah, come and you can have one of the rooms during the summer if you want to get out of your little town. Yeah. And so Bob, Dylan, Robert, what are we calling him, Bob or Robert?
Well, he's called Bob.
Let's call him Bob, little Bob. So he ends up in Minneapolis, and there's the musical area is called Dinky Town. And he quite soon goes out and about Dinky Town, hanging out in the record shops and the cafe bars, playing his guitar and stuff. So he's very independent, you know. He goes there, he doesn't know anyone other than his cousin, he has nothing in common with. And he just ventures out and makes a little life for himself on the music scene. So it was almost like music was his vocation and it was like the only thing he wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so as soon as he was old enough, he went to the next big metropolis and immerse himself. I guess if you're in Minnesota, Minneapolis is probably the nearest proper music scene.
I mean, it's really famous for the Minneapolis sound, which is through Prince and Terry Jam and Lewis and Janet worked there. And there's so many people came through Prince. There's so much jazz and funk in that area.
But Bob is really into folk music.
Obsessed. Yes.
What's interesting about that is that folk music is kind of passé now.
Yeah, it's
rock
really
and roll is ushering it.
Yeah.
Folk music's not really around anywhere. People aren't doing it, but he has got the horn for it.
He really does.
Yeah.
He's mad for it. And I guess it's a little bit veering into country music, and it's music that's come out of country folks' lives and just telling stories about real people. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's what he really, really connects with.
Yeah.
And the music.
So he did have to go further afield to find people.
Yeah.
He was never going to find it in his small town. And he starts playing in the bars. He's hanging out in the record shops.
Yeah, they're like coffee houses, pizza parlours.
The Purple Onion pizza parlour.
Yeah, the street and house parties. It's not even bars or not even clubs. There's nothing like that mentioned.
And, you know, he's discovering other folk artists by going to the record shop. Because, of course, they're not even playing it on the radio anymore.
No. By word of mouth and talking to everybody, someone will say, oh, so-and-so has got some records.
Oh,
my
word.
It's that hard for him to find them, isn't it? And they're rare. They're like one-off, never-been-reprinted records.
That blew my mind, actually, that folk were so rare at this point that he would hear that somebody in the next town has this record by somebody that he really wants to hear. So he has to go to that person's house and knock on the door and ask them if he can listen to the record. kids today don't know they're born. It's bizarre because you have Spotify and you can find anything these days at the touch of a button. It blows my mind that young Bob Dylan went to the next town because he'd heard somebody had a particular record that he'd never heard before. But I also think when stuff doesn't come easy like that, it makes it so much more meaningful, so much more exciting, because you're not literally sat on your laptop pressing a button. If there was something I wanted to hear now, I could find it, I could press play. Do you know what? After a minute, I might get bored, turn it off, be on to the next one. If you've walked across town, you sit there and you would give it your undivided attention, you would drink it in. It's a completely different experience.
Yeah, this book is peppered with times when he's heard this person for the first time or that person for the first time and the effect it had on him. There's tons of that in this book. He's actually lost his mind because of the sound and the meaning of the words and the this and the that.
He talks about Odetta, who I've discovered a few years ago through Bob Dylan, citing her as an influence. And he discovered her by going into a record shop and talking to them. And they said, oh, you have to listen to Odetta. They put it in a booth for him and he listened to it and it blows his mind. Yeah. But also at the same time, because he's a musician, most music fans and lovers would go in and listen to it. But actually he's listening to it, thinking about, oh, what's she playing? How do I recreate this sound? He's being directly influenced by her as well.
I tell you what, if you were doing a PhD on Bob Dylan, there's tons of information for that in here, because he also breaks down all the poets he's read, the books he's read that have influenced him, the stories. He's even been to libraries because he says he hates modern news. So he'll go and find some story about 1841 when some injustice happened and this, and he'll just absorb it. At this point, he's not even songwriting. He's just filling his brain with all the things he needs to become Bob Dylan, but he doesn't even intend to become Bob Dylan. He doesn't even think he's going to write songs. That's really amazing, because I absolutely love how he just needs to gather information all the time, but also how interesting it is that he talks about how sometimes he just loses the will, but he'll still be knocking it out. But, you know, he'll go on for 10 years just touring, making albums, but his heart isn't in it. But he's going through all the motions, not knowing why, and then suddenly something has sparked his interest again and he feels alive again. And then he realises he can do something in a different way. And he's found this different voice and he's re-inspired. But at no point has he actually stopped. Just like everybody else, like some people might go through 10 years of being absolutely miserable in their job and then something might just spark them and the next 10 years might... You know, but he's Bob Dylan going through all that, knocking albums out the whole time.
These people who we herald as geniuses, and let's say Bob Dylan, let's say William Shakespeare, let's say Vincent van Gogh, if you want to look through their whole body of work, it's not all brilliant, actually. There are probably, I don't know, let me pluck a figure out of the air, 10 genius pieces of work in their body of work. The fact is they were also prolific and they all just kept doing it. But of course, if you keep doing it, you're going to strike gold so much more often.
Yeah.
And that's what Bob Dylan is. That's what he does. Yes. He just is prolific. And no, not every album he does is great.
Sometimes he's going through the motions and other times he's suddenly inspired. And this could be years apart.
Yeah. Actually, one thing this book does do is lay down the creative process.
It really, really does.
Yeah.
All the things that inspire him and that he needed to absorb, which is tons over years before he could actually become a songwriter.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is just absolutely hero-worshipping other songwriters and actually breaking down almost mathematically what it is that made them make what they made, breaking down their lyrics, breaking down the music.
Well, you know, artificial intelligence does that now. No, like literally there are studios that feed in the number one records from the last 20 years and they'll get the computer
to write
the new number one song. Whereas Bob Dylan was actually doing that as a living, breathing artist piece by piece, and it took him years. They've actually have a computer program to do that now.
Yeah. Do you think you can make it get stoned as well and see what it comes up with? Because he never mentions anything like drugs or anything, but I'm pretty sure
there's
he's stoned.
There's a lot he doesn't mention.
Tons of the
book.
Time.
Yeah.
Tons of Bob Dylan facts missing out of this book.
He's really going through a voyage of research. He's drinking everything
in. He really is.
He's very sociable. He'll find people who can educate him. Yeah. Like he even befriends this old English literature professor and goes and reads his library. That guy turns him onto a lot of the old folk ballads, actually, which he didn't know about, the ones that were there from decades before. Yeah. Then he meets this woman called Flo, right? Oh, he moves out of the halls of residence. He gets a flat above the drugstore. And there's this girl that he notices from the coffee houses and stuff called Flo. One day he sat outside and she comes over and they chat. And she says to him, have you ever listened to Woody Guthrie? And he says, well, I've listened to him on other people's tracks. She said, no, have you listened to him do his own thing? And he said, no. She says, my brother has got his records. Come with me. And so Bob Dylan goes to Flo's brother's house. He's got like 8 Woody Guthrie albums. And that's where Bob Dylan has his epiphany.
Total epiphany. Becomes obsessed. Then he learns, or he listens to them enough to learn them.
Yes.
Because that's all he can do.
Yes.
Eventually moves to New York with just tons of Woody Guthrie songs in his armory to play at places, and tries to track him down because someone's told him that he's in New York, and he finds out that he's actually in a hospital in New York.
Yeah, he's not well. He's
old. So he does track him down. He takes a guitar and plays Woody Guthrie his own songs.
Yeah, he does.
And they make friends. He's there a lot.
Yeah.
It's really nice. I love this stuff. By the way, of having a lot of detail, how it can really help, because Woody Guthrie says at some point, I've got all these lyrics in a box, about 40 songs or something, in the cellar in my house. I'll let you have them because I'm not going to use them now. Here's my address. Go there and say to my wife that I've sent you. So it goes, and it's all the way in Brooklyn, and it's nighttime by the time he gets there. Obviously a different Brooklyn before it's all built up. Because he says there's this boggy marsh, and across it you can just see a light in the darkness, and he can't see any way around this boggy marsh in the dark other than to go through it. So he's like up to his knees. It's winter, frozen, stiff. He's, from the knees down, he's actually in water, wading across to get to Woody Guthrie's. You can just imagine it, can't you?
Yeah.
I'm picturing it almost like a Wuthering Heights or something. Then he gets there, rings the bell, and she's not in. And he doesn't feel he could ask the nanny or whatever if he could go in the cellar.
Yeah. He says that 10-year-old Arlo Guthrie answers the door and there's only a babysitter there.
Yeah, and he can't go in.
Yeah, he doesn't feel...
So he traipses back through the bog, freezing water. And 40 years later, Billy Bragg.
And Wilco.
Yeah, and Wilco go down into that cellar and get those songs and make an album.
I got the impression, there's only like 2 sentences of Bob writes in this book, that he doesn't like what Billy Bragg and Wilco did with those Woody Guthrie lyrics.
Yeah, because he should have had them.
He should have had them.
Well, he should have, actually.
They were his.
They
were. He was promised them first.
And if anybody should do them justice, it is him. Because he actually, in that epiphany, said he actually felt like Woody Guthrie has said, I hand this on to you.
Yeah.
This is the treasure. I hand this over to you. It's for you to take on now.
Here's the thing about these books that we're reading.
Yeah.
At certain moments, the people that are hugely famous, certain moments in time, they know it's going to happen.
They do.
Know how they have to
no
do it.
They have no doubt. At all.
And that's what happened here with Bob Dylan.
Yeah,
But here's the thing. Bob Dylan's started doing live shows where he literally just did Woody Guthrie songs.
Till he got a bit busted.
Yes, and then somebody said to him, hey, there's a guy called Jack Elliott who actually knew and come up under Woody Guthrie and he's done it before you and he's better than
you. And he was, he said.
Yeah.
So he had to find his own thing.
Yeah, which is what he then went and did.
I'm going to say this. He started playing in Café Wha, which is spelled WHA ? Like, what? And I've been there because above it is a theatre. It's in Greenwich Village. And the theatre owns the cafe. So I got taken down there and had a brilliant night.
Ah, really?
Without having to pay for anything. Yeah. And I found out that that place was owned by Dave Lee Roth's uncle.
Oh, really?
Somebody Roth. Vinny Roth, something like that. Yeah. So Van Halen started in Café Wha.
Did they?
Yeah. No, everyone's played there. Madonna, Prince, everybody you've ever heard of played there. At the time that Bob Dylan's talking, it sounded more like a casual cabaret and some comedy.
Yeah.
And there's no alcohol
like
down there.
A light entertainment.
Because I had a terrible hangover after that.
He says that after he would go on and the musicians would go on, like Woody Allen, Richard Pryor, Joan Rivers, and Lenny Bruce would all come out and do comedy.
Yeah.
But also some other variety acts, and he lists them. I think one of them, he said somebody used to come out and do facial acrobatics. I mean, what even is that?
That would have to be impressive to even be listed. It's ever so small. I mean, it's a really cool place.
So you could see somebody doing their facial acrobatics. I'm going to look into that. It might be bad.
I bet it's amazing.
Hey, didn't you say your auntie used to hang out in
In the 60s.
She was so she would have been part of this scene.
She was. She said she was mesmerised by Bob Dylan before he even had a record out.
Wow.
And she used to sit in the square there. And
Washington Square?
Just sit at his feet, cross-legged, and just watch him.
That's like history before it was history.
Yeah, I know. And then she started going out with the record producer who produced his first album. He was called Tony Wilson. He's not mentioned.
Really?
And I Googled him. There's a picture of him, very handsome. Bob Dylan making
to
his record.
Your auntie.
And she, and whilst they were, she was going out with him, she was in the studio looking through the glass, watching him record his first album.
Holy crap.
Just like that's just normal because it was her era. So
yeah,
it's
right.
Normal. Like if it was.
And he wasn't icon Bob Dylan at that point.
Famous.
He was just some
guy
recording.
Yeah, it's just when you happen to watch someone come up.
Wow.
Amazing.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Really amazing.
Right place, right time.
So Bob was playing in a few clubs around New York.
Yeah.
And there was one, the name Dave Van Ronk comes up a lot.
Yes.
Who I've never heard of, have
No,
you?
I've never heard of him. It was one of his heroes that he went to find in New York.
He's a very influential man. And he wanted to play because he had the Gaslight Club.
Yeah.
And Bob wanted to play in it, but he had no idea how to track this guy down. I think he was in Café Noir one day.
He was in the Folk Centre.
Sorry, okay.
Which is so cool. He was hanging out there all the time because it was actually a designated place. It was probably tiny, but just for folk music, and Bob Dylan's in there all the time. It also had stories and poetry and all sorts. And then suddenly Dave Van Ronk, his hero, is at the counter and he's like, oh, hi.
He says, how do I get to play at the Gaslight?
Yeah. I think, did he play to him there
probably.
And then? Yeah, so he was in.
He's in playing at the Gaslight for $60 a week.
Yes, and then he's in with them, like, hanging out upstairs, playing poker and drinking and making friends with his heroes. Oh, my God. He played harmonica on...
Harry Belafonte's
album.
What is it with Harry Belafonte? Why is he in everybody's book? I never expected to come across Harry Belafonte so often.
No. How could you see that coming? He gushes about him. What a legend he is.
Oh, there's about 2 pages in this book just saying how amazing Harry Belafonte is. But then that's what everybody says about him.
That's true. He does, to be fair, give about 2 pages or more to every single hero he has, which is great because he does go right into why they're amazing. Mm-hmm.
So Bob now is a proper fixture in the scene, right? Mm. He's hanging out with his heroes. He's playing at the Gaslight. And actually, Dave Van Ronk's wife, Terry, who books Dave Van Ronk's gigs all over the country, is beginning to book gigs for Bob, but closer to New York and not far out. So he's getting around.
True.
Oh, and he begins seeing this girl called Suze. It's somebody's sister. I can't remember.
She's the theatre one that gets him to go to all the... shows. So suddenly theatre's coming into his life and he's seeing all sorts of stuff. Is that the Kurt Weill thing as well?
Kurt Weill, Bertolt Brecht. She's doing a cabaret. He goes and watches it and he's blown away.
Like, it blows his mind. What's the song? Pirate
Jenny. He's blown away by that because essentially these are like folk stories and the people who tell the stories in Brecht and Weill are kind of the lower classes. They're the scamps and the scallywags, and it's the stories are really dark. And
they're about ordinary people's lives.
Yeah, so that huge influence on him.
Yeah, like he gets the words, writes them all down and goes and properly dissects them and why, how they're constructed. I mean, he does that musically and lyrically, as we've said.
So there's a song, Pirate Jenny. I don't think the song is actually officially called Pirate Jenny. I think it's become known as that now.
Yes.
It's from the Throttling Opera.
Yeah.
Pirate Jenny. And actually, I went onto YouTube. There's everyone from Bea Arthur to Nina Simone doing a rendition of Pirate Jenny. I watched Nina Simone. It's brilliant.
Wow.
And I can see how a young Bob Dylan sat in that theatre and thought, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Hugely influential on him.
All his influences, they're really vast, aren't they?
Yeah.
Jazz is another one.
Yeah. But he thought that the work of Brecht and Weill was actually very similar to folk. He described it as it being folk from a different jug. Really obvious parallels between what he had done up until that point. And just really inspired his storytelling and stuff, you know. And plus, it's really like those old stories he was finding in the old newspapers from 1850. It's a kind of similar things about washerwomen who used to murder people and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, hugely influential. So the next person to crop up is Carolyn Hester. So she's making an album on Columbia Records, and she wants Bob to come and play some harmonica. So he hangs out at her apartment. There's a guy called John Hammond, who is a talent scout stroke record producer. He's producing Carolyn Hester's album. And so he hangs out in a couple of the sessions, and he's quite taken with Bob. This is how things slot into place. Bob played a gig that week, and the New York Times came to review. And it just so happens that John Hammond had read the New York Times the morning that he went to Caroline Hester's session, and Bob Dylan was in the room playing harmonica with her.
But you're right, it elevated his status in his mind that day.
Yeah.
Great timing.
And so then after the session, John Hammond said to Bob Dylan, "Do you want to come and record for Columbia Records?"
Yes.
It's like, wow.
Music to your ears, literally. Yeah.
Oh, Bob Dylan says he took off like a rocket that day.
Yeah.
I mean, he did put the work in.
Yes.
But that was a very fortunate set of circumstances.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But you were in the right place at the right time,
aren't
you?
That's what it's
all about.
You're
playing the street, playing the cafe, playing everywhere.
Yeah.
You're buying every lottery ticket until one's the winning ticket.
Yeah, that's it. And John Hammond really had pedigree. You know, he discovered Billie Holiday, Cab Calloway, Benny Goodman, Count Basie, Lionel Hampton.
It's insane.
Who we know from Quincy Jones.
Yeah, so he's tied in with Quincy.
And folk music wasn't really on the major labels.
No.
But John Hammond says that he traces a direct line between Bob Dylan doing folk through the early traditions of blues and jazz.
Yes.
So John Hammond discovered all those famous people I just said and saw a direct line from them to Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
He's a totally musical person.
Yeah. And then he puts him in touch with a company called Leeds Publishing, who give him $100, even though they've only heard two of his original songs. Bob at the moment is just, again, regurgitating Woody Guthrie songs, Dave Von Ronk songs. So he's kind of just like improvising it. Anyway, so he gets a publishing deal and he's recording an album for Columbia Records. And then there's a manager on the scene called Grossman, and he wants to manage Bob. And Bob's interested in having him as a manager. But it turns out he's a bit of a Colonel Tom Parker character. He's very divisive, and John Hammond does not want Grossman to manage Bob Dylan, because Grossman has said to Bob Dylan, "I don't want you signed at Columbia. I don't want you signed with Leeds Publishing. You were under 21 when you signed that contract. It's actually not legally binding. Go and tell them." Bob Dylan was so grateful to John Hammond because he was the one who discovered him and took a risk on him. He said there was no way he was going to do that. So he said to John Hammond, because Bob Dylan's over 21 now, he said, "Redraft the contract. I'm going to re-sign it." Bob Dylan said there was a young guy who just started working at the office at Columbia Records. John Hammond got him to draw up the new contract and bring it in so Bob Dylan could sign it over the age of 21. And that person was Clive Davis.
Amazing.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. The guy who went on to sign Whitney Houston and become one of the most powerful men in the whole modern music industry. But Grossman was livid that Bob had done that.
Yeah. But I love that he was loyal to him.
Yeah.
And believed in him, same as he believed vice versa.
Yeah.
He doesn't really mention money, but he obviously did all right.
No, and I think, actually, I do think that the first contract with Columbia wasn't preferential. But then that's rock history.
Yeah.
Everyone we've talked about, from Wham to Rod, everybody got ripped off with their first contract.
Yeah.
It's just what happens.
Yeah. It's funny because he talks about, he actually, in this autobiography, suddenly leaps to having three kids.
Oh, that happens right now.
Yeah, you turn a page and I'm a father of three, and blah, 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 you're like, hang on.
Yeah.
And he doesn't say what happened in between at all.
No, and he talks about his wife, and it's like, which wife are you talking about at this
point? Yeah, he never mentions a name of any particular wife or kids or anything.
Yeah.
But that's his choice, and you can see why as well, because he's been hounded by not just press, but protesters and just people who want a piece of him, and he actually wanted to protect them. So you can see why he kind of keep them out of it.
Yeah, but I think we kind of know by now. Well, mind you, I don't know by now.
I know, I don't know. I don't know. I've learned what I know about him through this book, which tells me a selective amount. But he's got a house, a big house full of kids and stuff, and he has to keep moving around because he's getting plagued. And other than that, you wouldn't know. He drives around in his car sometimes and visits people. You wouldn't know he was a wealthy man, the only clue is one of his sad days is when he finds out his 63-foot yacht sank in the Bahamas, and that's quite jarring because you don't picture this folk hero as a 63-foot yacht in the Bahamas man.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's obviously spent quite a lot of time having a nice time in sort of paradise, but you can't picture that.
No, he was quite upset when it
He was very upset. So he's had another life that he'll never mention in this book. It's always cold and raining in his book.
Like we say, there are lots of things that are missed out of this book, not least the 10 years between signing his record contract and becoming massive worldwide music icon.
That's why this book almost is a song. It's the song he wanted to sing. He didn't want to sing the other stuff.
But it is very interesting in so much as what he's left out.
Yes, which we don't know much of. But you know what? You could read a biography about him.
I know for a fact that the guy who actually wrote his biography has said that this book is bunkum, it's all rubbish. Like Bob Dylan's made it all up.
Yeah, interesting. I really love when he describes a night he had with Bono. I've never heard anyone be so complimentary about Bono, you know, because he usually gets slagged off a bit. But he's saying he's a secret philosopher. He's read all these books. They've got so much in common. Their brains really connected over so much, the history of America, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah, and he said, also Bono and I both have is just this thing where we both talk and then he talks and I talk, and if we lose our way a bit, we just make it up. He said, we both just do that, so we're just talking bollocks. And I thought, oh, there you go. It's not important, the truth. Yeah. It's important to just let it all flow out, fall on the page, like painting.
What's interesting, you know, when he has his house in Woodstock and he thinks, you know, he's got a nice place for his family to live, but all of a sudden he is besieged by fans who see him as the voice of the generation. They're coming to his house constantly, even climbing up on the roof. They want him to lead them. And he just doesn't. What he said, I never made myself this. That's what they made me. And do you know what? I found that a bit incongruous, really, with him wanting to take the baton on from Woody Guthrie.
But he didn't know that you'd physically be besieged. I mean, visited in an hospital. Nobody cared.
That's true.
He didn't know that that would happen.
Yeah.
I mean, literally people almost violently protesting, saying you need to lead us to the White House to do something about the state of affairs, probably the Vietnam War, everything that was going on. They wanted him to be political.
He says he was uncomfortable with his leader of the free world status. He said, I'd been anointed as the big bubba of rebellion, the high priest of protest, the leader of the freeloaders. And actually, he never wanted any of that.
Yeah.
That's what his public made him. So in a way, if he doesn't relate to that, almost, you know, quite a few of these people we talked about, like Tina Turner, was very different offstage as she was on stage. So actually, through reading this book, I've discovered that Bob Dylan, because to be honest with you, before I read this book, in my head, I thought he was the voice of his generation. Right. I thought he was leader of the freeloaders. Actually, he's uncomfortable with that. Bob Dylan is a stage name.
Yes.
I wonder if Robert Zimmerman, who's really passionate about folk music, then became massively famous. But the price of that success, his image got distorted and he became somebody that he didn't really want to be.
That's definitely the truth.
Yeah.
And he said all he wanted was a quiet life with his wife and kids, and he just wanted to take them to school and back.
That's amazing. I have a quote out of the book. He's on a road trip with Robbie Robertson from the band, and this is at the end of the 60s, so he's had 8 albums out. And he is, as far as everybody's concerned, Bob Dylan is the voice of his generation. Robbie Robertson says to him, where are you going to take it? And Bob says, take what? And Robbie Robertson says, the whole music scene.
Yeah.
It's like Robbie Robertson, who is another successful musician,
thinks that Bob is in charge of where the music scene goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's stuff like that that blows his mind.
But he probably is to a certain extent. But then Bob says, I don't know what everybody else was fantasizing about, but what I was fantasizing about was a 9-to-5 existence, a house on a tree-lined block with a white picket fence, pink roses in the backyard. That would have been nice. That was my deepest dream.
Yeah.
He wanted to just be a family man.
And you wouldn't know that because that's not in his song words. He says one headline said, spokesman denies that he's a spokesman.
Oh, really?
He feels like a piece of meat thrown to the dogs. He says, creativity is experience, observation and imagination. But now I can't observe without being observed.
Mm. That's the thing, isn't it? There are lots of these people in folk who literally make a living out of being a folk artist, and they completely fly under the radar of the mainstream, and it's just purists and genre fans who bother about them. But when you become Bob Dylan, you're mainstream property.
Yeah, exactly.
And you get distorted and your message gets distorted. And yeah, I think he's paid the price of that, actually.
I do too. Another example of this is he goes to pick up an honorary degree from New Jersey, and he gets introduced as, they say, although approaching the perilous age of 30, he remains the authentic expression of the disturbed conscience of young America. He says, oh, sweet Jesus. He's just waiting to get this thing, and he gets introduced like that. And he said, it really woke me up and jolted me out of myself. And I mumbled and whispered through it. I couldn't believe that they'd said that that's what I was. He's a musician. Yeah. No, he's the consciousness of young America.
Well, America needed someone.
They needed someone, and they picked him, and he didn't want to be picked.
Yeah.
And they couldn't get rid of them. He'd move and they'd follow, and he'd move and they'd follow. So he said he ended up like making a massive effort to preserve his life, to change his image by pouring whiskey over his head and walking into a department store mumbling. So people, he can't lead as if he's this idiot. And then recording a country album just to ruin his image. He actually sabotaged himself on purpose to get peace. And once he had peace, he then knocked out a load of albums that no one's heard of and no hits, and just became a jobbing musician and a touring man. But it's actually very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. The success you have is not in line with the success that you wanted, that you dreamed about. Maybe you didn't even want. Who really wants that much success? Because he is literally as big as any modern recording artist ever was.
I mean, you know, lots of people have hit songs, but they're not called upon to lead people to the White House or change what's in the news. He said he just wanted out of the rat race.
Yeah.
It really disturbed him what was happening in the news, presidents being shot, all that stuff. He didn't want any part of it at all. Just accidentally wrote songs that seem to lead people. Times they are a-changing.
Yeah, right. The thing is, it's like it's a protest song, although he really claims he's not a protest singer.
Mm.
But, you know, he's such a poet and he's so socially conscious. I think by default, you are just political anyway. Yeah. Can I tell you my theory about this book?
Yeah.
I think it's a puzzle to be solved.
Oh.
I think it's written so abstractly in places. The reason I think, I don't know Bob's catalogue inside and out, but he talks about recording The Man in the Long Black Coat. And I know that song inside out because Joan Osborne covered it, and it's one of my favourite albums. And just before he talks about it, one of the lines in the book is something along the lines of, that was vile and depraved. That's a line out of The Man in the Long Black Coat. So because I don't have extensive Dylan knowledge, I'm wondering if this book is peppered with little Easter eggs and lyrics
if
and jokes.
Fan.
And yeah, if you were a fan, I bet there's so much more to be taken from this book. I bet there's lots of little puns and codes to work out. I bet, because it's such a weird book and it's not straightforward. So if it wasn't some kind of massive Da Vinci Code to unravel, why would it be written like this?
Yeah. I really warmed to it. You got in about 75%.
Yeah, but when I read it again, when I read it again, I loved it.
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
I loved the bits about his early life and his rise to fame. The whole endless chapter about him recording an album, I didn't want to read the second time.
Oh, that's funny, because I did skip that the second time round, but it's all the just the descriptions. I really like that he was touring with the Travelling Wilburys.
I love the Travelling Wilburys.
Oh no, it isn't that though, but yeah, there he was in that. He was touring with Tom Petty and the Pacemakers for 8 years. Pacemakers.
Heartbreakers.
Oh shit.
I mean, I think they probably all could use pacemakers now.
Yeah, how old were they? It was the 80s. All right, he was touring. Anyway, he had a break from touring and he went to make an album with the Grateful Dead, which is, that's a really cool mix. He wasn't really in the mood and they wanted a load of his old stuff. And he said, oh, I haven't been doing that old stuff. And he couldn't bring it out of his head and he didn't think he was in the right place and he got really stuffed up doing it. But he never really communicates to anybody, does he? If he was all miserable, he doesn't really say anything. So he was just suffering in his head quietly. And then he said, I just walked away. I just walked out of there. And he walked down the street and he just walked past a bar. He's going to go back to the hotel. And he walked into this bar. There's some jazz playing. And he sat down and he totally dissects what this jazz was. He just completely breaks down why this jazz was blowing his mind because of this and this and this.
Was it the singer? Does he name the singer?
He does name all of it, but I didn't.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
But the singer had an unusual way of phrasing.
Yes, that's right. And it just flipped his head. And he was like, that's how I need to approach this. And he stayed and listened to the rest of it and then went back. And they didn't know he'd walked out because he didn't think he could carry on. They had no idea. Comes back and does this album with them and it just releases his mind. And all sorts of technical things release his mind. So after that tour, he's ready for a whole new change. There's great stuff like that.
He's just open, isn't he?
He's really open to everything around him that can affect you. I am too, aren't you?
Yeah.
This is how I walk around in life.
Yeah, we're artists.
Yeah, so you take that in so that can come out there. Yeah. And everything's available to you if you want to hear it and see it. And there's another time when he's got stuck on that album in New Orleans. I love his descriptions of New Orleans. It's brilliant. And he goes on a bike road trip with his wife and he goes into a really tacky gift shop type place. And the way he describes that, and I think because I've seen his art, it's very America.
Yeah.
It's very Americana.
And on the road.
He paints those pictures, but they really capture a time. And so do his stories sometimes of America. It's a certain America that he's capturing in these little...
I tell you what it is. It's America seen from his tour bus.
Yeah.
You know how he was on tour, the never-ending tour for like 3 years.
A very folk view.
Yeah. He's just constantly informed.
It goes in and it comes out.
Yeah.
At one point, he talks about an intricate wrought iron gate that he's welded from junk. He's even welding gates. I mean, you know, it's amazing.
He is. He's just prolific. He has a need to create.
Yeah.
It's just a shame he couldn't write a more straightforward book.
It's good writing. It's lyrics.
Oh, yeah. To just sum up the book, I did enjoy it. After not enjoying it at all.
Yes.
The first half, I just wanted to give up. I found it quite impenetrable in places, but I warmed to it. And then weirdly, the bit I was most interested in, which is the beginning of his story, is the last chapter.
Yeah.
By the time I read that, I was into it. So I actually went back and read the bits I liked in order, and it just made sense.
And you're going, who are you, though? Who are you? Who are you? And then right at the end, he goes to the beginning of who he is, and you go, oh!
Yeah.
That's how you started. You don't have to start at the beginning, actually.
No, you do.
Okay.
But also, he names a lot of people through the book, but then that last chapter actually tells you how he met them and stuff. And so it just makes it, oh, now I know who that person is. Now I know who that person is.
It's harder work. It's like how films are made these days. They are all out of sequence, aren't they? They make it harder for you to grasp it. It's not all on a plate for you. Mm-hmm. And then that's why things are classics. And those films that are all out of order are often the ones people do watch over and over again. Maybe that's like this book.
Because obviously we're reading things at a certain speed for this podcast. Maybe if I had more time to enjoy it.
You're on a desert island for a month.
Yeah, I'd read it 3 or 4 times and thoroughly enjoy it.
You actually really would.
Yeah.
And it would probably end up being the book that you'd have to take to desert islands because there's so much in it to pore over.
You know, the things that surprises me most about this book are the things which I would consider, not being a massive Dylan fan, which are really important in his life. He just doesn't talk about them. Don't forget, once upon a time, he switched from acoustic guitar to electric guitar and the whole world ended for lots of people.
Right.
He doesn't even mention that.
No.
And he starts off one of the chapters by saying he'd really hurt his hand. He doesn't say how.
No.
Right? He had a really bad motorcycle accident.
He does mention another accident at some point.
Yeah, I know, it's confusing.
Right over these things.
Yeah, I know. So why not tell us about that?
He doesn't want to be like everyone else.
No, I know, but that gets a bit wearing. And I tell you the most important thing he never talked about, which is my favourite Bob Dylan moment.
Yeah.
We Are the World.
He was in We Are the World.
Have you seen, you know, the bit at the end where they're all in the chorus singing together? Oh, my God. Go on YouTube now. Everyone listening, go on YouTube. Look for the short clip of Bob Dylan in the chorus of We Are the World.
Does he look awkward?
He clearly doesn't want to be, clearly doesn't even know the words.
Oh, no.
And everybody is around him singing their hearts out. And he's looking around really confused, just like mumbling.
Really?
Oh, my God, it's glorious. It's my favourite Bob Dylan moment. So are you a fan of Bob Dylan now?
I'm way more open to all folk music. Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, it really has made me pay a lot more attention to Bob. How about you?
I liked him in the first place, but I feel like he's inspired me to get my whole career going, which is just weird because I'm so over it. I haven't even thought about doing it again ever.
Wow.
And now reading this book, which I kind of semi hated.
Yeah.
It makes me think, shit, I was really good at this. I should be doing
it.
And
that you can have 10 years off and 10 years on.
Yeah.
You can go through huge phases. If you're lucky enough to live long enough, there's still time to do stuff.
Yeah. So I'd like to say thanks to Bob Dylan in so far that his book, which I didn't like that much, it really inspired me.
And you kind of loved it a bit.
I did love it, actually. Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I love him.
So do I.
Do you, though?
Yeah. No. No, I think he's a complicated man. I think he's probably quite dark. It's complicated.
Yeah.
He's complicated.
He is complicated. This book was complicated.
And he's a complicated man.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Thrift Shop Biography. We love making this podcast and we're absolutely thrilled that so many of you are already listening. You could really help us out by leaving us a review somewhere, wherever you listen to this podcast. And if you could share us, tell your friends about us or drop some links on social media. We have a Facebook page called Thrift Shop Biography. So make sure you come over there to hear about the episodes first and what else we're up to. Okay, see you next week. And if you're new here, there are loads more episodes now to go and listen in the back catalogue, so make sure you go and enjoy them. Okay, thank you very much.